From the KGOU studios, I'm Brian Hartzinski, filling in this week for Suzette Grillot, who's in Arezzo, Italy, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'll talk with Joshua Landis about a Kurdish victory in a major town in Syria against the Islamic State, and why the Kurds have done so well against Islamic State militants when Arabs and others haven't.
The Kurds were very united, and they wanted to fight against ISIS, so they became the perfect partners for the United States.
Then we'll hear Suzette Grillot's conversation about some of the problems associated with natural resource extraction in Latin America.
If you view these issues in the context of human rights, what you realize is that communities that are affected by extractive industries have been marginalized from society historically.
Assessing the costs of natural resource extraction right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Brian Hartzinski, filling in this week for Suzette Grillot, who's in Italy. We're here with Joshua Landis, and he's going to tell us about what he called a major victory this week in Syria. Kurdish troops took the city of Tel Abyad with the help of U.S. air support. And Josh, you said it's caused a major controversy because it's in an Arab region. Tell me about that.
Well, Tel Abyad is an important town because it's a big crossroads between Turkey and ISIS territory, Islamic State territory. And the United States is engaged in this bombing campaign to try to destroy the Islamic State. Kurds, an ethnic group, they're not Arabs. They speak a language that is related to Persian, stretch along the border between Syria and Turkey. There's an almost 600-mile border between those two countries. The Kurds are strung along a big patch of it. And the United States has been bombing in front of Kurdish forces, and they've been stretching, taking this long string of the border between Turkey and Syria and denying it to the Islamic State. So they have really been our single, real reliable partners in Syria. And Tel Abyad was the big crossing, and it is between two pieces of territory that the Kurds own, Kobani and the Jazeera. And this links the two up, and it shuts the door on a big crossing. So it was an important victory.
So what are the Kurds doing right? What have they done that's made them so successful while the Iraqis and other Arab entities have not against the Islamic State?
Well, the relationship between the U.S. and the Kurds has really blossomed in Syria. It had blossomed already in Iraq, and the United States is in many ways, if not the author, has been really the handmaiden to producing a quasi-independent Kurdish state in Iraq. In Syria, the Kurds were very united, and they wanted to fight against ISIS, which was pushing them out of this territory that they have along the border. So they became the perfect partners for the United States. They like the Americans. They have embraced women fighters and liberal values, and they've helped minorities and so forth. So they've put on a very good propaganda campaign, and they've helped America tremendously.
So since they've helped America tremendously and there's this Iraqi regime that we've been propping up now for the past 12 years, ever since the 2003 overthrow of Saddam Hussein, why is that? Why are we having such success working with Kurdish forces that we're not necessarily seeing with Iraq?
Well, there's a number of reasons. One is that the Shiite forces of the Iraqi government are very disunited. There is the Iraqi army, which we helped put together, which has collapsed in large part, but it's supported by a number of militias, Shiite militias. America doesn't like to work with those militias because they're not the state. The Kurds, on the other hand, are very united, and they're very pro-American. They have not been supported by Iran. The Shiites in Iraq are supported by Iran, which is a traditional enemy of the United States. So those have created tensions. The second major reason is that the Kurds are taking territory which is largely inhabited by Kurds. So they're fighting for their own homeland. It's very easy to support them. In Iraq, the Shiite government is fighting to take back cities like Ramadi, Mosul, which are Sunni cities traditionally. So they're fighting in a sense in foreign country. And this creates a whole host of problems that America is reluctant to get into.
So what's next? What's a benchmark for success?
Well, that's the real question, is how does the United States pursue this battle against ISIS? If the Kurds have taken all the Kurdish territory, they don't want to go and take Arab territory. We don't have good partners in Syria after the Kurds stop taking Kurdish territory. And in many ways, we've come to the end of the line of our policy of using the Kurds to roll back ISIS in Syria. Just in some ways, as we've met the same difficulty in supporting the Shiites in Iraq, because now they're taking Sunni territory. And this is the underlying weakness of our battle against the Islamic State. They're a Sunni force in this big expanse of Sunni land that stretches out between Baghdad and Aleppo on the other side in Syria. And we don't really have partners to destroy them, because counterinsurgency 101 says if you want to destroy a counterinsurgency, you've got to produce a better government than that insurgency can produce. And we don't know how to do that for the Sunnis. We can't put Shiites on top of them. We can't put Kurds on top of them.
Definitely something to continue to watch. Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the author of the blog Syria Comment, thanks as always for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about this conversation, you can leave a comment on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org, where you'll also find a link to Joshua's blog, Syria Comment. You can also contact him directly with your questions via Twitter at Joshua_Landis, and you can follow this program at Worldviews KGOU. Coming up, Suzette Grelot speaks with two experts about the potential risks of natural resource extraction in Latin America and what extractive industries are doing to mitigate those risks for affected communities. I'm Brian Hardzinski, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Brian Hardzinski. Today we'll hear Suzette Grelot's conversation with David Deisley and Tom Perot about the effects of natural resource extraction in Latin America. Deisley is currently the executive vice president and general counsel of the gold mining company NovaGold. Although NovaGold operations are concentrated in North America, Deisley has worked throughout the Western Hemisphere during his 25 years in the mining industry. Tom Perot is a geographer and has spent his career studying the relationship between social movements, resource governance, and development in the Andes region of South America.
David Deisley and Tom Perot, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're here to talk about the relationship between mining and extraction of resources and environmental circumstances or conditions or outcomes of that. And Tom, I'd like to begin with you to maybe give us a little historical perspective about kind of the history of mining and some of the problems we've seen historically and how that perhaps has changed throughout time. The work that you've done in Bolivia, for example, in the past and some of the criticisms that have emerged and then kind of where we are today.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is very important to understand about mining in Latin America is the kind of deep historical roots that it has, particularly in certain areas, more so in some parts of the region than in others, of course. But the Spanish came looking for gold. That was one of the main things that the Spanish were looking for. And of course, the civilizations that were in Latin America prior to the arrival had lots of gold. So the Spanish could, you know, they arrived in Mexico, they arrived in Peru and found these very wealthy cultures with lots of gold and other metals that they were working. And so one of the things that they did very quickly was look for mineral deposits and begin mining. And they did so in really brutal ways. And one of the main sources of revenue for the Spanish Empire for about a century and a half during the late 1500s up through the 1600s and early 1700s were the mines at Potosí. And what's what's now Bolivia. So at that time it was called Upper Peru. And it provided a source of gold, source of wealth for the Spanish Empire that really funded the Spanish Empire and all of their various wars during that period. The famous pieces of eight from the Pirates of the Caribbean were the coins minted in the Americas, and in one of those mines or one of those mints that minted those coins were in Potosí. It was fabulously wealthy at the time, and you can still see the remains of that kind of colonial city. I mean, it still is there at about 14,000 feet, very high elevation, and now it's one of the poorest areas in all of Bolivia. So there's a long, deep history of mining, not just there, but in Mexico, in Peru, in Chile, in Colombia. And this one of the issues around this is that it has left a big environmental legacy of that, because a lot of the historical mines are leaching what's called acidic mine drainage from tailings or mineral that's been worked in the past. As water flows through that as precipitation, it oxidizes, and then what flows out from the bottom of that is acidic. And so even tailings that are very, very old can produce acidic runoff that can affect waterways and whatnot. So there's a long historical legacy of mining in many places. In the area where I work in Bolivia, the mining isn't as old as that, but it does go back about 100 years. And so this is one of the major problems. And this, the Bolivian state hasn't had, I would say, the political will or much technical capacity to really deal with that. And so a lot of the state-run mines – well, there's one state-run mine now. A lot of the mines that are run by these mining cooperatives are done with minimal or no environmental safeguards. And so not just acid mine drainage, but a lot of the chemicals that are used in processing mines, a lot of heavy metals that are used in processing mines like mercury, cadmium, the list goes on, are sometimes discharged directly into waterways. And so this creates a huge problem for environments, for people that live downstream. So it's important to understand that mining – there isn't a single mining industry or a single type of mining in Latin America. There's lots from sort of very large-scale, highly capitalized, very modern mines to these very small-scale artisanal mines, some state-run mines. And so there's a whole range of things. And so some of the problems – there isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all solution to dealing with some of the problems.
But clearly, there's that potential negative relationship between the mining and the environmental consequences. But so, David, I want to turn to you because you're working in this industry, in the gold mining industry, also in Latin America. So tell us about what your industry is doing to help mitigate some of these potential consequences, these potential negative consequences.
There are a variety of things that the mining industry is doing around the world. There are organizations that are based at the national level, like the Mining Association of Canada. There's also a larger organization called the ICMM that is International Council on Mining and Minerals, which is not just gold mining but a variety of leading mining companies in the world. And these industry organizations have developed standards that apply to a lot of the legacy issues that Tom mentioned. And they deal with environmental issues, labor issues, interactions with communities. In addition, the United Nations from 2006 to 2011 asked Harvard professor John Ruggie to develop a system for providing guidance to businesses generally, not just mining industry, but all businesses that work on an international level. The result of which in June 2011 was the adoption of the United Nations Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. And those provide a guidance for businesses when they do work internationally as how they can honor their obligation to respect human rights while recognizing that the duty to protect human rights is a duty of the state, the nation state. Both states and business have an obligation to provide effective remedy when human rights are infringed. And I think from my perspective, it is what creates great opportunity for mining industries or extractive industries in that as an industry, we are dependent on where the minerals or the resources are. So we can't decide to open a factory in one country or another. We have to go where they are. And as we do, I think the industry has a great opportunity to be an effective force for remedying many of the legacy issues that have plagued the industry, as well as to be an effective catalyst for development.
That was David Deisley, an expert on resource extraction in the Western Hemisphere. We'll hear more of his conversation with Suzette Grelot right after a short break. I'm Brian Hartzinski, and this is Worldviews. Welcome back to Worldviews. I'm Brian Hartzinski, filling in today for Suzette Grelot, who's in Arezzo, Italy. Today we're hearing her conversation with David Deisley and Tom Perot, two experts on resource extraction and its impacts. Before the break, Deisley told Suzette about various standards and safeguards in place to try to ensure that extractive industries conduct their operations responsibly.
So on that note, Tom, in terms of these activities obviously being a catalyst for development, I mean, it seems to me in your work in Latin America, you might suggest that even though there are some, you know, we can definitely criticize this industry, we can definitely see the negative consequences, but that it isn't realistic to think that they wouldn't extract these resources. As David said, they're there, and they're there to be extracted, and they're valuable, and they lead to development. Is that the case? I mean, are they leading to development, and is it something we just should expect them to do, and so therefore we should be working with them to make sure that they do it in the most sustainable and environmentally friendly way as possible?
Well, I think you have to qualify those statements. I don't think it's a simple sort of either or, black or white situation. I think there are a couple issues that I think the potential is there for extractive industries to foster development, certainly. And countries around Latin America, throughout the region, left, right, and center, and I mean that literally in the political sense. So countries on the left like Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, countries in the center like Chile, Brazil, and countries that at least recently have been more on the right, now kind of more center right, like Colombia and Peru, have all thrown themselves 100% into extraction. So it's not a political issue in terms of, you know, right or left, you're either for extraction or against it. There are some differences in terms of how it's done, but the differences are relatively minor for the most part. There are some exceptions, and Venezuela is a big one. But for the most part, it's not a political issue. And so, yes, extraction is happening. That's the reality. So then you can say, you know, should it happen? How will it happen? And then I think you get into sort of the big question. How does extraction happen in such a way that actually fosters meaningful and sustainable development, right? Development that's going to last and kind of build on itself, as opposed to creating wealth for a small set of people or, you know, political cronies or political elites that are already there. There's no question whatsoever that extractive industries, so not just mining but oil and gas and timber harvesting and, you know, a range of others, create tremendous wealth. Whether they create development and what kind of development depends a lot on the institutional framework that's in place. And this varies tremendously from country to country and within countries. And so I think this is where I think, you know, David, I'm sure, would agree with me and you know, argue that this is where the industry is working hard to create an institutional framework that will foster that. And on the other side of that, of course, is the states themselves. What kind of institutional framework exists within the central government and then to a certain extent within subnational governments as well when rents are distributed to, say, departments or provinces or municipalities, what happens to those funds? And, you know, this varies quite a lot.
Well, I think that throws us back to you, David. And as we were talking earlier about the standards and the framework and the principles that have emerged to guide industry in this way, I mean, we were talking about in the context of the environment, you mentioned, though, that the focus is on human rights. The principles have to do with human rights. And I presume that that gets to this larger issue of ensuring that local populations are involved in some of these decisions and that they aren't the losers in this relationship and that they actually benefit from the resources that they're providing. Is this something that is actually happening? These international organizations and norms and efforts, frameworks that are emerging are actually doing what Tom is suggesting and trying to move us more down that path? Because, you know, some would say that the perception is anyway that multinational corporations go in and they, you know, take and don't give back. Is that not your experience in your work with this industry in gold mining?
That is certainly my experience, and it's certainly what motivates me in doing my job on a daily basis. I think that one of the things that Tom mentioned early on was is part of the legacy issues is the Spanish came, they took from the mines and took it back to Spain where it had value. And you see that as well in many communities where the royalties and the rents go to the central government and they are not reinvested. And I think that if you view these issues in the context of human rights, what you realize is that sustainability is not purely an economic issue. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the indigenous communities and frontier communities that are affected by extractive industries development at the frontier have been marginalized from society historically in terms of economic authority, political power, access to the things that people who live in the more urban areas take for granted, whether it's education, medical care, access to infrastructure, whether it's telecommunications, roads, power. And part of the transformative and sustainable development that can come out of investment, in my view, is to readjust that power imbalance that has been historic. And when I have worked, we've gone about this with the idea from the ground up. And so you begin to work with the local communities, not tell them what you're going to do for them, not throw a bunch of money into a school and say good luck with that, but help the local communities develop the capacity to make intelligent decisions about what they see their future being. One of the topics that's important has been in great debate in the industry over the past 5 or 6 years is the concept of free, prior, and informed consent. And it's been characterized, in my view, all too often as yes or no on this project, when in my view, if you engage in meaningful consultation, I think that most communities would like to see economic development in their community, but they want to have control over the way it's done and how the benefits of that are distributed. And I don't think that that is an anathema to the industry at all. In fact, I think it creates the best value out of converting, as you said, these resources in the ground that have no value into products that are saleable in the international market. And as Tom pointed out, the question is how does that conversion process result in meaningful development for the people who live and reside in the areas where the extraction takes place?
Well, clearly the importance of these resource issues are significant today and will continue to be so well into the future. So thank you both, David, Tom, for being here today and helping us understand a little bit better what the issues are that we're facing. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you. You've been listening to Suzette Grelot's conversation with David Deisley and Tom Perot about the potential social and environmental damage of resource extraction in Latin America and how industries are working to protect against those risks. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU in collaboration with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Symphony Swift directs the research for this show and books our guests, and Sam Dupre produced this episode and wrote our digital content. For Joshua Landis and Suzette Grelot, I'm Brian Hardzinski.